What is going on, guys? This is Brendan Burns, and welcome to the Brendan Burns Show. Join me as I interview, dissect, and share the stories of high performers who have created the life that they deserve on their terms. I sit down with speakers, professional athletes, and successful entrepreneurs from all over the world who have chosen to live a life of fulfillment and joy over status and money. In each episode, I share actionable strategies that you can implement in your life, plus inspiration along the way. So come join me for this episode of The Brendan Burns Show. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of The Brendan Burns Show. Joining us today for the second time is Dr. Robert Glover, an internationally recognized authority on the Nice Guy Syndrome and the author of the book, No More Mr. Nice Guy. Dr. Glover is a frequent guest on podcasts and radio talk shows and has been featured in numerous local and national publications. Through his books, online classes, workshops, podcasts, blogs, consultations, and therapy groups, Dr. Glover has helped change the lives of countless men and women around the world. As a result of his work, Dr. Glover has helped thousands of nice guys transform from being passive, resentful victims into empowered, integrated males. Along with these personal changes have come similar transformations in these men's professional careers and intimate relationships. Dr. Glover is the creator of Dating Essentials for Men, the director of TPI Diversity. Dr. Glover, welcome to the show.
I hate listening to bios. I'd rather, let's go back and listen to that music. I like that little riff you had going on there.
You like that intro, right?
Yeah, did you create that? I thought he probably did that on his own computer.
You know what? I grew up listening to a lot of hip hop in New York, you know, Eminem, Jay-Z, all these guys. And so my podcast intro is my one way to have my own hip hop expression.
There you go. There you go. Like I said, I'd rather listen to that than my intro. I'm thinking, did I write that? Come on. I'm Robert. I'm alive. I live in Mexico. That's enough.
All right. What's up, Robert? So, you know, we've had you on the show, but it was 4 years ago. So for those who either didn't catch that episode or are excited to dive in, tell us a little bit about your background. How did you realize you're a nice guy and develop this kind of concept of nice guy syndrome?
I guess I realized I was a nice guy when the woman I was married to said, I'm leaving you if you don't go get help. And I thought, wait a minute, I'm a nice guy. How could there be a problem here? And that really is how it started. I was in my second marriage. And my then wife basically said to me, you know, everybody thinks you're such a nice guy, but you're not. You treat me bad. You can be passive aggressive. You can have victim pukes and blow up at me, and I don't even know anything's wrong. You know, I can't trust you anymore. You don't tell me the truth. And you know, I'm leaving. So I'd rather be with a jerk, because at least I know a jerk's going to treat me bad all the time. You know, you're nice to me, and then you're not. And I go, okay, you know, you're the one that's never happy. You're the one that's always in a bad mood. You're the one that hates yourself. All right, I'll go get help. And luckily, I landed in some good places. I landed in a 12-step group that was really helpful. I got in with a therapist and joined a men's group I was in for several years. And all of that made me start recognizing the roadmap that I was living by of being a nice guy. And if you've met me back then, I would have told you, I'm a nice guy. I would have told you that. Kind of like, you know, how do you know if somebody's a vegan? Well, they'll tell you. And, you know, how do you know if somebody's a nice guy? I'm a nice guy, you know. And I thought if I just, you know, was different from my father, different from, you know, because my mother raised me to be different from my father. She told me that when I was a kid. And different from all the women I heard women complain about, you know, when I was an adolescent, different from all the men I heard the angry feminist in the 60s and 70s complain about, you know, every man's a rapist and erection's a sign of aggression. You know, I grew up hearing that stuff. I'm not going to be that guy, or the guy that only wants one thing from women, right? No, I won't be that guy either. So I was just trying to not be, you know, whoever I thought the people around me thought I shouldn't be. Growing up fundamental Christian, trying not to be, you know, a sinner either, trying to be. So I was living this paradigm that if I just was good enough and hid enough stuff about me, I might be liked and loved and get my needs met. And I'm a marriage and family therapist by training. So at that time I had a private practice, and so guys were coming to me. Guys were coming to me with their wives or girlfriends. And I started noticing they were saying the same things I was. I'm a nice guy. One of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. I treat her better than her ex. I'm raising her kids. I give her everything she wants. I get her the new car, the leather interior. You know, I help out around the house. I do the shopping. I do the laundry. It's never enough. When's it going to be my turn? Oh, and she never wants to have sex anymore. You know, they all said the same thing. And yeah. then the single guys, they would say, I have lots of female friends. Women tell me I'm an amazing guy and I'm going to be some great catch for some lucky woman someday, but they don't want to be my girlfriend. You know what? I listen to them talk about their problems. I make their car payment. You know, I help them move. I help their sister move. I'm different than the jerks that they complain about that they keep going back to. What's wrong? So I started a No More Mr. Nice Guy men's group. We met every other week, and I soon started another one, and I started writing just lessons to give the guys that I was learning about me and learning, listening, you know, talking with other men who identified as nice guys. And over time, about 6, 7 years, that turned into a book. Guys kept telling me, this could be a bestseller. You should go on Oprah. I never made it on Oprah, but the book is doing well, so that's good. And just kept working on it till I got it published. And, you know, I think first came out as an ebook around 2000, 2001. It came out in print early 2003. And so I've written 3 more books since. And I'm still a recovering nice guy and still working with recovering nice guys. And so that's my gig. That's my story.
I love it, man. So why, you know, like if these men are so nice and willing to do all these things and sensitive and connect with all these women, why aren't women attracted to these men? Like what makes them friend zoned?
At least a couple fundamental reasons. One, they're boring. Number two, they're not trustworthy. You know, nice guys are chameleons. So I'll be whatever I think you want me to be. It'd be like if I came on your podcast and every time I said something, you nodded, I kept saying that those same things. Oh, I got a good response. But if you looked perplexed, oh, I better not bring that one up again. I probably wouldn't get invited back to many podcasts. I'd be boring, right? Yeah. So nice guys tend to be boring because they're chameleons. They're Teflon men. They're trying to, with women, they use what I call nice guy seduction. Oh, if I just listen to her talk enough. If I help her do things, if I solve her problems, if I hide any sexual agenda, because I don't want to be like those bad guys that you know, I hear women complain about, which leads to another problem. You know, nice guys have this really brilliant idea that if I hide my sexual intentions from this woman, she'll want to take her clothes off with me. And I'm thinking, I used to do that, but it makes sense, you know, when you're a nice guy, because we think if we're different than those other bad men, women will flock to us, but they don't. They don't. I found that out firsthand. Nice guys create no emotional tension for women. Being nice and pleasing and doing things and giving gifts doesn't turn women on. It actually works better if you tell the woman, do this for me or give me this gift or, you know, something like that. Because there's actually a psychological principle that when people give you stuff, it doesn't make you like them more. But when you give them something, your brain rationalizes, I must like them or value them because I just gave them my time, a gift, whatever. So it actually makes them seem more likable to us. Yeah. So as a little psychological, you know.
No, it's right, you know, I remember when I read your book, I was living in New York City at the time, and I was always like, oh, let me do this for you. Let me get you this, you know, big pleaser, big nice guy. And I remember I was at a dinner party, and just as an experiment, I was there with a friend and she was, you know, closer to the room where our coats were. And I just said, hey, Anna, give me my coat. And she was okay. Yeah. Let me go. And she got it. She brought it back to me. And it's just, you can just see that people are more into you and attracted to you, want mm-hmm. closeness to you, men or women, not even sexually, just they respect you when you're willing to say, I'm worthy. I deserve asking for you to do this for me. You don't have to, but hey, grab my coat. It's just like these subtle psychological things make a difference.
Even if we don't feel worthy or deserving, yeah, there is something. Again, it's just a reverse psychology. Doing things for people does not make them like you more. But we think it should, but it just doesn't.
That's good, man. So nice guys often hide who they really are. Why do they do that? And then what problems does come out of that?
Yeah, I wrote a book about that.
Yeah, I mean, the short answer.
Okay, the short elevator pitch. You know, There's a lot of things that can contribute to a man or a woman, because there's a lot of nice girls out there as well. I actually think, and I could be wrong, there's no way to statistically prove it. I think if you go back 50 years, you probably had a lot more nice girls than you do today. And if you went back 50 years, you probably had a lot less nice guys than you do today. So, we kind of have this model that, oh, with the patriarchy, men are evil and toxic masculinity, and they've been, abusing and hurting women. And it was true. That was all true. But it almost seems like we've flipped it. And now the girls are the mean ones, and the guys are the passive ones, not wanting to rock the boat or upset anybody. So, what I think has happened for a lot of men is that, number one, probably a lot of nice guys just kind of have an easygoing temperament. I tend to. I go along to get along. That's kind of who I am. I like what I like. Every woman I've been with has called me controlling, but I just know what I like. But I don't try to control anybody else. So I just, if I like this at a restaurant, I'm going to order that at the restaurant. That's not controlling. It's just what I like. But a lot of nice guys just have pretty easy temperaments. My mother, when I was somewhat younger, used to announce to any woman I dated, "Oh, Bobby never did like conflict." I think, who the hell likes conflict? I don't. Can we just talk about it and come up with a solution and be done and move on? But I do tend to be attracted to women who like conflict. I seem to draw women to me who like to fight. So it's toughened me up somewhat. So it might be just be temperament is part of it. Okay. But every human being, when we're an infant, we come into this world totally dependent, totally needy, totally mature, totally vulnerable. And we're dependent on our caregivers to look out for our needs and take care of us. And none of us come into a perfect world with perfect parents, no matter how good of parents we had. We're going to have experiences as infants where we're cold and nobody wraps us up. We're hungry and nobody feeds us. We mess our diaper and nobody comes to change us. We have a bellyache and nobody burps us. We're going to have painful, uncomfortable situations. That feels like a death experience to a child, because children just feel everything intensely. And on an emotional level, they're narcissistic in that they believe they're the cause of everything that happens. It's true for every child. Okay? So that means every time a child experiences a discomfort, they emotionally internalize. They don't think about it because we don't have that mental capacity yet. The brain isn't finished wiring up. But we emotionally internalize this as really as trauma, and that somehow we caused it. Again, we don't think that out. It's just an emotional response. So every human being tries to do two things to deal with that discomfort and that fear, is they try to manage the discomfort they're feeling. And so, like, a child might cry, they might sleep, they might suck their thumb, they might wet themselves. I mean, who knows? Any number of things. I sucked my thumb till I was in kindergarten. You think maybe I had some uncomfortable, experiences that I was trying to medicate. Every human does this. And the other thing that every human does, again, using a very primitive, immature mind, is that we try to do whatever to prevent those painful things from happening again in the future. Right? This happens to all of us. I mean, but there's many different ways, as many different personalities as there are. There's that many ways to try to manage the discomfort we're feeling and prevent it in the future. And again, this is all coming using a brain that has about the capacity of an iguana, right? It doesn't have the ability to think things out. It's just purely reactionary. And so then we grow up, we get a few more years older, we hit adolescence, we're still doing the same thing. And by now, we have an internal emotional thermostat. And so, like, I've got an air conditioner right up here behind me, and it's set at a certain temperature. It's set at 25 degrees Celsius. And it's got a thermostat. If it warms up too much, it kicks in to bring the temperature back down to 25. If it gets below 25, it quits making it cold until it warms back up again. A good thermostat, I shouldn't notice a change in temperature, right? It's true with our emotional thermostats. Our emotional thermostats are so fine-tuned that if we start to feel any discomfort, it kicks in, using some sort of emotional management technique that maybe we've been doing since we were 2 months old. We don't know that, but it's what we've been doing. And so whatever discomfort arises, we find a way to manage that. And then we also develop these roadmaps and these paradigms to try to prevent those things from happening again in the future. Now, if we want to bring this like into relationship, because that's my background as a relationship therapist, that means we go through adolescence and adulthood trying to find love, trying to find people to love us that we can love. And all the while, we're terrified of getting hurt, and we're trying to prevent anything from happening that might hurt us. Now, if anybody listening that's ever been in a relationship, probably gotten hurt, right? It's the nature of relationships. So that means we are going into situations that are guaranteed to hurt us in some way or another, doing our damnedest not to get hurt, and maybe even hurt them before they can hurt us. And that's how we're trying to get love. Right. So we all have this emotional armor on. This will protect me from getting hurt. You know, maybe it's the way we keep a distance. Maybe it's the way we try to be funny. Maybe it's the way we don't reveal anything. Maybe it's the way we don't talk to anybody. So we got our emotional armor to protect us. Then we got our weaponry, our offensive weaponry. Well, if I think they're going to hurt me, I'll hurt them first. Yeah, I'll take a poke at them first. I'll do that first. So sorry, our lightsabers, our wit, our anger, our withdrawal. And it's kind of like from the song, Hallelujah, what I learned from love was how to shoot who outdrew you. You know, all right, they're about to outdraw me. I'll shoot them first. That's love, right? According to Leonard Cohen. Right. So that's what we're all doing, because we learn to do that to manage our discomfort as little babies. And we come into adulthood. A Buddhist monk by the name of Pema Chodron has a really good book called The Wisdom of No Escape. And it's a series of lectures she gave that are just about that very thing of how we're trying to do relationship, you know, get close to people with this armor on and our weaponry out. And the other people are doing the same thing. They're armored up and they got their weapons, and we think we're going to get close. No. So really what we do is we end up just hurting ourselves and hurting everybody else in the pursuit of trying to be loved while protecting ourselves and being on guard. So, but we all do it, but we just don't know that's what we're all doing.
Right. Yeah. It's just kind of like creates the opposite effect of what we want anyway. But I want to ask, so as babies or very young children, if we're abandoned, neglected, we don't get the love we need, we internalize that, make it about us, which then creates that toxic shame and low self-esteem that nice guys have. Is that correct?
Yeah. I don't love the term self-esteem. Yeah. I know it's a common word in psychology, but you know, there's a lot of words that we've used them enough that we all just assume it must be real. It must exist. And everybody knows exactly what we talk about when we use that term. Okay. There's a lot of terms like that. But the problem I have with self-esteem is that, you know, there's no real fix or remedy for it. You know, do you think, and where is it? Where's it stored up? You know, if I have it, where's it at? If I don't, where'd it go? But I think there's a lot of other models that work better than a model of self-esteem. But yeah, I do believe in that model of toxic shame. Now, when it comes to self-esteem, your listeners might relate to this. I've never once heard a successful person attribute their success to high self-esteem. Not once. Have you ever heard anybody? Have you ever heard anybody say, I'm successful because I have amazingly high self-esteem? Ooh. No, they say, I worked hard, I did this, I got lucky, blah, blah. But everybody I've ever talked to who wants an excuse for not doing the things that scares them uses low self-esteem as excuse. Oh, I don't talk to women because I have low self-esteem. Well, I don't ask for a raise because I have low self-esteem. Or I don't, you know, set boundaries with my parents because I have low self-esteem. But I never hear successful people say the opposite. So I don't think it works well as a model to actually make changes in life. Now, toxic shame, I think that's something that actually can be worked with, because it is something that everybody does internalize, because as infants, we all have uncomfortable experiences. And it is something that actually can be pretty simply addressed. It seems simple. You know, like I say, early in No More Mr. Nice Guy, and I say it a lot, go find safe people, therapist, coach, men's group, women's group, 12-step group, rabbi, pastor, somebody safe. who's not going to judge you, who has no desire to shame you, and start revealing the things about you that you've never revealed, that you have shame about, that you don't want people to know about you. And the process of doing that begins to release these inaccurately internalized beliefs about ourselves that we're somehow bad, unlovable, not good enough. Now, again, you know, I guess we could just easily call that self-esteem. But I found it much easier to work with the concept of toxic shame. Mm-hmm.
Makes sense. So again, just to kind of go back then to this concept, like, is it the case then that these experiences early on in life, we internalize them, we make story, we don't even have the, I guess, brain power to realize it's not about us. We yeah. build that toxic shame. And then how is that shame kind of at the core of a lot of nice guys with the hiding and the pleasing and the, you know, I don't want to take up space or have needs. And then how that plays into dysfunctional relationships.
Yeah, well, I wrote a book about that too.
you know,
when I wrote No More Mr. Nice Guy, I really focused on the idea of toxic shame and how this feeling that I'm not good enough, something's wrong with me, I'm not lovable, leads to that, well, okay, I've got to become something different then. I got to become, you know, happy, smart, sexy, lovable, successful, perfect, whatever, to be loved and liked and get my needs met and hide anything about me that might get a negative reaction, my needs, my wants, my opinions, my desires, my sexuality, right? So that those are all real common patterns in nice guys. And so we're going through life doing that. And then we hit adolescence where we want to be liked and accepted by our peers. We want the opposite sex or same sex to desire us. And so those patterns almost get magnified as if they're on steroids. Oh, they are on steroids. All the hormones pumping through the body in adolescence magnifies those patterns. So we try even harder to become something other than what we are. Try even harder to hide anything about us that might get us rejected or cause people not to be attracted to us. And then so they really get cemented into our personality as we go through adolescence. And then we hit adulthood and they're there. Like I said, they're just on that thermostat. They just kick in without us. We just think this is me and this is how I fit into the world. And oftentimes, for example, going back to early my second marriage with the woman who said, "You go get help or I'm leaving you." I remember she was really into self-help and reading books and she loved going to therapy. And she would be like reading John Bradshaw's Healing the Shame That Binds You. And she'd be reading, go, "Oh, this is you. This is you." I go, "What?" And she'd read it to me. And I go, "That sounds like you. You hate yourself." "Yeah, I don't hate myself." She goes, "No, this is just like you." And I go, "I can't even relate to that." And which was interesting because I already had a PhD in marriage and family therapy at that time. And I couldn't even relate to the concept of toxic shame. And so I guess I must have figured it out because any number of people have told me after reading No More Mr. Nice Guy, "I really understood toxic shame after reading your book." I thought, okay, good. Maybe I got it figured out. But why that was for me is I realized when I started working with nice guys, I assumed we were all the same. You know, we haven't had the same contributing factors, the same world way of seeing ourselves, same way of seeing the world, but I was wrong. I mean, there's many, many, many different ways of manifesting nice guy syndrome. What I noticed, I assumed at first all nice guys were like me. And I've come to call that the "I'm so good" nice guy. Over time, I found out, well, no, actually, there's a whole nother category that I now call in the book the "I'm so bad" nice guy. And what the primary difference is, the "I'm so good" nice guy experienced these uncomfortable, painful experiences as a child. And I'm not trying to like even blame parents because, you know, any number of these things could have been nobody's fault. I was born with a cleft lip. I had surgery at 5 days old and then again at 5 years old. I know that must have been traumatic. Okay, that's nobody's fault. But I know I must have internalized it. Maybe that's partly where the thumb sucking came from. Who knows? Okay. So at an early age, the "I'm so good" nice guy starts inaccurately internalizing this toxic shame. And it's not thoughts, it's not words, it's in our emotional operating system, down in a part of our brain. This is the brain stem down here at the bottom of the brain called the amygdala. It manages survival. It manages a fight, flight, freeze reaction, manages respiration, manages heartbeat, and it stores up emotional memory. So it's a pretty amazing little part of the brain. It's a really old part of the brain. And so that emotional memory gets stored up. Now, it's not words, pictures, logic. It's just feeling state of I'm not good enough. Later on, we attach pictures to it, videos to it, so to speak. Oh, I got rejected by that person. That's proof I'm not good enough. Or I made an F in school. That's proof I'm not good enough. We will attach things to the belief, but the belief is like our machine language, the operating language. Everything else is apps that we layer on top of it. So the I'm so good, nice guy had experiences where at a very early age, pushed the shame way down in kind of a, airtight, sealed compartment, but yet started trying to be good. Okay. If you think about it, why would a child try? I mean, try to be good, develop a roadmap that says, I've got to be good if they didn't feel like they were bad. If they didn't feel like, if a person doesn't feel like they're bad or anything wrong with them, why would they try? Right. They would just be themselves. But nice guys are trying. Okay, so I've been spending all my life trying to be good and be liked and loved and get valued for being good and hiding things that weren't good. My shame was really pushed way down to where I didn't even know I had it. But the patterns around it were manifestations, kind of like how like astronomers and physicists watch things. Oh, they go, oh, that planet or that star is in an elliptical orbit. It must be being influenced by something, right? So now they go look for what influenced the pattern of that heavenly body. So same thing. If you see certain behaviors in people, you go, what is causing that? What's the influence of that? All right. The other kind of nice guy is what I call I'm so bad nice guy. This is the person who at a very young age typically got in trouble a lot. They acted out, often had ADHD, maybe were in an abusive, toxic situation, addictive home. Maybe they couldn't sit still. They forgot things. They broke things. They tripped over things. They acted up in class. They got sent to the principal's office. They got scolded. They got spanked. They got grounded. They got told how bad they were, how stupid they were. They often started doing drugs and alcohol at a really early age, maybe having sex at an early age, maybe dropping out of school, and their lives were just spinning out of control till something happened. Maybe they got in the military and kind of got straightened out, got married, kind of got straightened out, had a kid, found Jesus, whatever. Then they thought, I can't keep living this way. I got to change that. And so they try to become a nice guy. Oh, I'll just do everything right, and hide anything about me that might, hurt me. And but their shame is always, it's here. They're walking around going, oh, if I let, as soon as anybody gets to know me, they are going to see what a fuck up I am, how terrible I am, what a mess I am. And so they guard, to make sure people don't see it either. So I'm so bad, nice guy, shame is up here. I'm so good, nice guy, shame is way down here. But we're both still driven by shame. Now, this was the kind of the core principles I was working on when I wrote No More Mr. Nice Guy. By the time I finished writing it and kind of was in the process of publishing, I also over time really became aware that a lot of what drives nice guy syndrome is anxiety as well. That everything a nice guy does, nice girl does, is to manage anxiety, whatever those states might be. And again, it might be about being found out, not being good enough, doing something wrong, getting punished, having other painful experiences. And so at about the time the book came out, I remember I was leading about like five No More Mr. Nice Guy men's groups a week. And like almost weekly, in every group, the guys started saying, let's talk about self-soothing. Let's talk about anxiety. Because everybody's going, I can't do this because I'm anxious. I can't talk to women because I'm anxious. I can't talk to my boss because I'm anxious. I can't set a boundary with my parents because I'm anxious. I can't even like get to the gym because I'm anxious, whatever it might be. So nice guys carry a lot of anxiety. So I've really come to see that anxiety and shame are kind of these two foundational pieces between, the people I identify as those nice guys, seeking approval and validation, hiding anything that would lose approval or validation.
Right. Yeah, I saw that in I think a updated prologue or something to your book, where you said I talk a lot about shame, but what I've realized is there's also anxiety plays a big role in
And
this.
yeah, I wrote a preface to the No More Mr. Nice Guy about 15 years into it. They said, "You want to do an update, a rewrite?" And I said, "No, I like it. Let me just let's clean up a few of the errors that are in it, and let me write, you know, a new preface, forward, whatever they call it." And lo and behold, so they cleaned up all the errors, and the publisher made a whole new one that it was pretty significant. And I didn't realize it. I went back to New York a year or so later to read it for yeah. Audible. But in there, just so everybody knows, if you read the book, there's when you get to the caring versus caretaking, and there's two lists that describe the differences between caring and caretaking, the publisher got them totally reversed.
They're opposite. Yeah.
They're opposite. And I didn't get that. I'm reading it. You know, I'm in the sound booth in New York, and I told the producer, wait, I had to look at it and go, that's wrong. That's completely wrong. They reversed that. And somebody, you know, one of my coaches is leading a No More Mr. Nice Guy reading group. And he just wrote me last week, says, Robert, chapter 4, the caring versus, I already know, caring versus caretaking. We've talked to the publisher how many times my agent has, they still haven't fixed it. But so those of you reading the book, if you get to chapter 4, just know those two lists are reversed.
Yep. Got it.
I'm not messing with your mind. It's human error.
There you go. So, you know, just thinking about kind of your experience, you're in that first marriage, you start to realize, okay, maybe I have the shame. Maybe I am a nice guy. What were you sort of dealing with, struggling with, working out as you were moving forward from kind of that point to where you are today?
Well, at that point, my biggest issue, you know, if you know, for people who've read the book or who read it or listen to it, this will probably show up. My biggest issue is in relationship. And so No More Mr. Nice Guy, a lot of it is about relationship. I mean, there's stuff in there about work and career and other things as well. It's funny because the book is often listed on Amazon, like in the top 10 books for dating. I mean, I've actually got two books on dating. No More Mr. Nice Guy. I'd never dated at all well before I wrote that book. It's a good dating book, I guess. But it's primarily about relationship because, you know, if you think about it, the way you date determines the kind of relationships that you end up with, the people you end up with. But so my biggest issue really was around relationship. I was struggling in that marriage with my then wife. And we'd been highly sexual before we got married. On our honeymoon, she announced, "Now that we're married, aren't you glad we don't have to pretend to like sex anymore?" I wasn't pretending, but I was a nice guy. I can get her through this. I've got superpowers. I can make everything good. And yeah, you know, I just had learned that as a child with my father. I can, you know, my dad was angry and moody. Well, I can work it. I can work it. That was a challenging relationship. I'm grateful for it. We were together. We're married 14 years. I'm grateful for it because it was the big stick that just got my attention and woke me up. She was kind of a force of nature in her own way. You know, one minute she loved me, next minute she hated me. We never did have very much sex after getting married. And so those were the things I was struggling with. And, you know, it really put a big spotlight on my conflict avoidance, my approval seeking, my hiding of behaviors, my dishonesty, my lack of connection with men. I was always seeking approval of women. My lack of boundaries. I didn't even know about boundaries. I was in my, you know, in the second marriage with a PhD in marriage and family therapy in my 30s. Before I went to a therapist who taught me about boundaries, I'd never even heard of them. Okay. So the intensity of that relationship really, as I said, was a big stick and put a bright light on all my deeply dysfunctional patterns. And so I'm really grateful for that because I think it took that. I think it took some radical surgery to really wake me up to where how deep my nice guy patterns affected so many areas of my life. Now, I also began to go from there to look at myself in work and career and how my nice guy patterns showed up there, avoiding taking risks, you know, trying to have people's approval, not wanting to fail, not wanting to make mistakes. So I started working on that. And that's an area of life now that I'm really focused on because I've launched a new company. I'm already swimming in deeper waters business-wise than I've ever been. I'm loving it, but I'm finding out I can't be a nice guy. I'm running a company. I've got like 25, 30 volunteer people working with me. I've got, several employees. I've got members of, some men's programs. So I got members. I can't be nice. I can't go into that nice guy pattern of trying to, avoid conflict, seek approval. This company won't make it, if my nice guy patterns show up. So it's been great. It's been kind of the next phase of me really going even deeper into my nice guy patterns.
Yeah, I've had to work that out too, having a couple employees and virtual assistant, ads bot, like all these people for my company.
Yeah.
Man, you, like consequences, boundaries, open direct conversations,
Yeah,
calling people out.
communication, those 2 minute difficult conversations that are easy to put off for way too long. Yeah, that stuff.
Yeah, no, for sure. I've been there. I've been working that out over the past kind of year, me myself.
It's great, isn't it? When you actually start seeing, go, wait a minute. I need to just be direct with this person. I need to stand up and deal with it. I need to set a boundary. I need to say no. That wasn't done right, and it needed to have been done by, I need to start like, with love. I mean, I give my employees lots of love. I've got a couple of employees. I tell them good night every night. Love you. Glad you're here. And one's in India, the other's in Mexico. So lots of love and just clear, firm direction and clear expectations and clear evaluation for if the job's been done right the way I want it. It's like, yeah, can't be nice.
Yeah, that's totally in agreement there. And then just kind of going back to sort of the dating thing, what I heard you say is, your dad maybe was angry and difficult, not fully present, et cetera. And you were like, as a nice guy, you're like, okay, I'll figure this out. This is fine. And then when you saw that in your first wife, instead of walking away, I remember in No More Mr. Nice Guy, you say, I shouldn't have gone on more than a second date with her or something
You
like that.
probably got that from my dating books,
Okay, for
actually.
the
I was, and actually,
dating
this was my second wife.
book. Yeah.
I was actually still married to her when the book came out. We split just a few months before the print version came out, back in 2002.
You split
And
with your first wife,
no, my second wife,
second wife. Okay, with no
the
more
woman I've
mistake.
been referring to mostly is my second wife. My
Okay.
first wife is the mother of my son. I was married to her for about 10 years. What you've probably heard me say is that these first two wives, I was married to the two of them for a total of 25 years,
Yeah.
and I should not have gone over three dates with either one of them. And again, not because anything that was bad about them, but my first wife, we weren't a good match, and it was pretty obvious early on. But I was on the rebound. I'd just gotten out. I was a sophomore in college at that time when I met her. Rebound, I'd gotten out of a relationship with now what I understand to be a borderline personality woman who was hot, cold, hot, cold, hot, cold, hot, cold. And so, she was a good person, but we weren't a good match. You could even ask her that. She'd probably tell you, we weren't a good match. But we stayed together for 10 years. We were both amazingly conflict avoidant, and neither one of us were good enders. My second wife, we were actually both married when we met. So that should have been a good reason not to date or get involved. But it's kind of, again, oh, this will work out okay. I know. Well, I mean, that was like 40 years ago, back in, my pre nice guy recovery. So both relationships began while I was still dyed in the wool nice guy. And yeah, so many things happened, especially in that second relationship. Like I said, I knew nothing about boundaries. So many things happened that it's kind of like that any one of them should have been deal breakers. No, this I won't tolerate this in relationship.
Okay. And so when you say deal, would you have like immediately set a hard boundary, or would you have just left and not gone on more dates?
Well, it just depends, because certain stuff showed up while we're dating, and then other stuff showed up once we got in
Okay.
relationship. I tell people in terms of dating and conscious relationships, I say one of my mantras is go as slow as possible to find out as quickly as possible what a person's nature is. And in my experience, this is maybe my experience, but I think it takes at least 3 years to really know the depth of who somebody is, even with conscious dating, right? Every relationship I've had that's lasted 3 years or longer, so let's say maybe half a dozen of those in my lifetime. At about the 3 year period, I found out something pretty significant that I didn't know, right? Either they kind of voiced an opinion or a point of view that I go, well, I wouldn't have seen that coming, or started revealing things about themselves, their past or their present, that they kept secret from me that probably should have been shared with me early on. So almost in every case, yeah, I found out something, way after the fact. And because I'm way back then, I wasn't good at setting boundaries. I still have to work at setting boundaries. I was not a good ender. I would just think I can make it better. I'll just work at it. They're good traits. Maybe they're good traits that I like because they all had good traits or I wouldn't have been with them. Their good traits will expand and their bad traits will diminish. And only one person in my entire life has that actually happened. Everybody else I've been with, their good traits shrunk over time and their bad traits grew over time. And every one of them at some point or another, so let's say about five other women in my life, at some point, usually about 3 years or earlier, kind of dug their heels in and said, basically, don't expect me to change anymore. Don't expect me to grow. Don't expect me to be more loving, more sexual, more communicative, more, qualities you need to have an, it was basically, and then I'd often stick around about another 7 years and then like act badly and the relationship would come to an end. The one exception is my current wife. We've been married 7.5 years. We've had our issues, we've had our struggles. Pretty much kind of the same issue we've kind of, but it's been a great growth opportunity. And I was just writing in my morning journal this morning, just the just the growth both my wife and I have made. I mean, if you look at where we were 7 years ago, we were pretty toxic with each other, with her patterns and how that triggered my patterns and how I responded. And I was writing this morning, we're in a really good place. And one of the things is that I've known about my wife ever since I really got to know her. I mean, see, this woman has more trauma than any person I've ever experienced. And I'm a therapist, right? She grew up 8 out of 10 kids in poverty in Guadalajara, Mexico, alcoholic father who left when she's five, physically abused by siblings, sexually abused from age seven, number of traumatic experiences, a terrible relationship with the father of her two children. This woman has more trauma than anybody, molested by a priest. And when she told her mother, said, don't be disrespectful to the priest. Then they found out he was molesting all the young girls in the parish. So all of this, but I've always known this thing about her is that she's willing to face her fears, to just really go in to her stuff. And I tell her she's my role model. I have high regard for that. A few years ago, 3 years ago, I got invited to be a guest speaker in an ayahuasca ceremony in Costa Rica. She went and like she loves it. She loves, after second ceremony, I met all of my abusers and I forgave them all. I'm going, that's pretty big. And she just loves that work. And then just like yesterday, she started seeing a new therapist. And I'm not sure I really even understand exactly what the therapy is. I think there's some numerology involved with it, but yesterday afternoon, she just walks up to me and just kind of starts crying. So I'm just holding her. And she just, I said, you want to go in my office and, sit down. The house cleaner was there. And she just says, yeah, I was in my, this new therapist. She's talking about my rape. She's talking about my father leaving. She's talking about my abortion. And she's just crying. And I'm just going, man, I've got so much respect for this woman that will do that deep work. So that's rare. I unfortunately, it's rare. Like I said, most of us were so armored up. We don't let people see that depth of who we are. We just don't let them see it. And we keep them at that distance. And if we're going to have love, if we're truly going to experience what we all most crave, and that is to be deeply loved, we got to be willing to be vulnerable and let people see us and take that risk and get hurt again. So, kind of going back to answer your question. I haven't been a good boundary setter. I came up in my dating books of a rule. Now, actually, I think this is in No More Mr. Nice Guy. I call it the second date rule. And it says that if you're in a long-term relationship and your partner does something that you would not have tolerated on a second date, if she'd done it on a second date, would there have been no third date? Okay. But if you think about it, the longer we get in relationship, often for most of us, the more we tolerate. And it's mainly because, you know, a partner does something. Yeah, maybe it's, you know, it's we fight about it, we have this, but you know, we do value them and we have sunk cost. You know, we've got a lot invested in this relationship. Often we don't want to go out and start a whole new, another one all over again, or be single or be alone. So we try to figure it out. We try to work it out. We try to make it work. But unless a person is willing to address their behaviors that are toxic, dysfunctional, harmful in relationship. I remember when I marriage therapist, I mean, for many years, I worked with lots of couples. And I remember there were times, and I'd usually ask women this question, because you know, some behavior would have been identified, and that you know, it's like she would be controlling or nagging or mean or hurtful to her partner. And sometimes I would just ask them, I said, "Do you know that that is hurtful to your partner and damaging to your relationship?" And like almost 100% of the time, they go, "Yeah, I know." And I go, "Why do you do it?" "I don't know. I can't help myself." All right. That's not a good candidate for a relationship. A person who does things that they know are hurtful, but can't help themselves. Now, we all act on impulse. We all have reactions. We all have that stimulus response thing. You know, the stimulus hits, and like Viktor Frankl says, there's a gap where you can either respond or react, basically. And how we learn to manage that gap says everything. But the problem is, we create these relationships often at a very unconscious level. We go out and pick people. I think it's Pia Melody that said we tend to pick people who have the worst traits of both of our parents. So we pick, you know, like me, I pick women that were angry and moody like my dad. Or I'm also highly attracted to unhappily married women. Why? My first love object was an unhappily married woman, my mother. She stayed an unhappily married woman till my dad died about 11 years ago, right? My job was go be the good guy, the good man who would be different from my father and you know, be my mother's companion. I was really parentified by my mother. So I'm attracted, highly attracted to women either who are in relationship and unhappy or have a long story, a long history of unhappy relationships. Oh, yeah, that's my sweet spot. You know, that's where I work my best. Now, add one more piece into this. Like I said, I'm giving you the whole mess of why relationships are so challenging.
Do
Okay.
it, man.
So we're, not only is each person projecting all of that stuff onto a partner, the people we're with are projecting all their childhood stuff. They got together with us because we have the worst traits of both of their parents. But here's one more thing. This one took me a few relationships to figure out. You know, probably, you know, three marriages and a few other relationships in between. Every relationship is going to introduce you to something new that you didn't know that you don't want in a relationship. Think about that. Say, well, first relationship, you're with somebody that doesn't manage their money. So, you know, and you go round and round and round about that one. Finally, you go, okay, I'm not doing that one again. Next person I get with, they're going to be financially, fiscally sound. So you find somebody. Oh, good. Don't have that problem. Oh, but you know they have difficulty like asking for what they want without yelling at you. Well, you didn't see that coming. You didn't know you didn't want that. You hadn't dealt with that one before. And so, but see, and these new things you don't know how to deal with because they're new. They're new, and so you try to manage them rather than say, "If you ever yell at me again, it's the last time you're going to see me," or "You know, you can't manage your money. I'm not going to keep seeing you." You know, you would do that if you had good boundaries, or you know, and then maybe you get with the person that can't ask for what they want without yelling at you, and you get with a, you know, "I'm not going to do it, get with a yeller again." You get the next person you get with, they just clam up and withdraw when they're upset. Say, "What's wrong?" They don't answer. "You buck, what's wrong? Tell me what's wrong." If you have to ask, I'm not going to tell you. I've heard that one, right? And so you keep getting the ones like I didn't see the one coming where, you know, my second wife, you know, we're having lots of sex because we're having an affair with each other. You know, we leave our partners, we get married. Like I said, honeymoon. Oh, we can quit pretending to like sex now. I didn't see that one coming, right? You know, we were already married. So that happens in relationships. So I'm a big believer that Conscious relationships are just a great way to wake us up. They're powerful personal growth machines. They're not meant to work. I'm not even sure they're meant to make us happy. That's an illusion we all have. We can make them work. They can make us happy. I'm not sure they do. Not overall. I mean, if I ask most people, say, look back on all the relationships that you've had in your past, and most of them, we're not with them anymore, right?
Yeah.
Have in general, they made you more happy or unhappy? People think about it, unhappy. So maybe that's what they do. Maybe they're not really meant to make us happy. That's an illusion. That's, you know, that's the whole, you know, romance novel, the whole, you know, Hollywood movie, the whole love song thing. Yep. I'm told Shakespeare wrote Romeo and Juliet to show up, to show the fallacy of romantic love. You know, we love each other so much, let's kill ourselves, right? And how many people have you been with, have I been with? You know, they met them, they fell in love with them, they thought they were fucking amazing, they couldn't wait to, wanted to be with them all the time, wanted to have sex all the time, they're amazing. We're not with them anymore. What happened? What happened, right? So relationships are challenging. They're challenging, but again, they're such powerful personal growth machines if we'll use them consciously and use them to clean out that old baggage, that, you know, that stuff we brought from mom and dad and those early life experiences, to look at our own, you know, armor, to look at our own weaponry. Let's use them to look at that stuff. And usually we need some help along the way, you know, good therapist, good coach, someone like that. Doing it on our own, it's going to take way too long. I read one time, might've been Scott Peck, I don't recall, that said that therapy is the only legitimate shortcut in life. And you know, that's not a bad idea. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. And so, you know, sometimes good help can help a lot of this stuff, a lot quicker than just bumbling our way through it on our own.
Yeah, no, that's good. I mean, yeah.
Did I answer your question along
you
the way?
You answered a lot of good questions there, man. There's a lot of juice in there. This is like a go back and listen to four times episode. But one of the things I'm taking away, and I want to make sure I heard you right, is your current wife, healthiest of the marriages you've had, sounds like.
Yeah. Oh, she's as messed up as anybody I've been with, but I think we have the healthiest relationship of any that I've had.
Yeah. And that's what I was going to say, is like, maybe the benchmark isn't how healthy you are, but how willing you are to lean in and
yes.
do work. Right.
Yes. Yeah. My wife, she's Mexican and, doesn't speak English, not much. She can, but a little, she doesn't. But she's got a phrase, and I've loved this phrase about her since day one. And her phrase is, si yo quiero, yo puedo. And that just says, if I, you know, see, yeah. Down San Diego, or maybe New York you picked up. I remember first time I took Lupita to New York, actually to record the Book of No More Mr. Nice Guy. I was in recording the first day, and I get back, you know, to our Airbnb, and she'd gone up to Midtown Manhattan and had just bags load of basura. Hats, key rings, garbage. Yeah. I said, how'd you get there? She goes, I walked. And I go, you know, we'd actually walked there the day before from like Soho, you know, up to Midtown.
Right.
And I said, well, you didn't have a map with you. You know, she goes, I just remembered how we got there. And she goes, and I go, and you don't speak English. She goes, oh, everybody here speaks Spanish. And I go,
yeah, it's true.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I think pretty much everybody in most parts of New York speaks Spanish.
Yeah. Well, you have the Dominicans, Puerto Ricans, people from
Cubans,
Latin America, Cubans,
Mexicans.
And then all the white people like took Spanish up into, you know, through middle school, high school typically.
Yeah.
So they know
yeah.
enough to get by too.
Yeah. Yeah. If you've ever worked in a restaurant, you get fluent in Spanish, no matter where the restaurant is. At least all the swear words anyway. So anyway, I love that phrase, si yo quiero, yo puedo. If I want to, I can. And she really lives her life that way. And she says she's not going to let any fear stop her or block her. She says she's going, voy a brincar. I'm going to leap over that fear. And, you know, I tell her, again, she's my role model. Because I've always been an optimist in a relationship. And I've always believed I'm going to bring my A game. I'm going to show up. And, you know, again, my biggest frustration in past relationships is just show up. Just show up, you know, come do the work. And again, a lot of people in life, and I've come to a painful conclusion. Now, I think actually a really beautiful conclusion about life is that we're here to get our hearts broken. I think anything that's good enough that can break our heart is so good we wouldn't have want to have missed it. And that's where the best stories come from. That's where the most growth comes from, is really opening up to being hurt, to being getting our hearts broken. And living life trying to avoid getting your heart broken, how painful is that? And how much pain do we actually inflict on ourselves and other people by protecting ourselves from having our hearts broken? But I think it just makes a lot more sense as, show up every day and just love the people in your life, love the things you have. David Snarch, Compassionate Marriage, says in every relationship, somebody's going to get left. I find that liberating. A lot of people find it painful. No, I don't want that. I don't want to get left. So I'm going to guard myself. No, it's the impermanence that the Buddha speaks of. Everything comes and goes, manifests, unmanifests. Nothing lasts forever. But we kind of think, well, okay, I don't want. So we're here to get our hearts broken. Now, here's another piece that I've discovered along the way as both a therapist, just personal experience, is that as much as our deepest desire is love, to feel lovable, to love, to be loved, most people will choose their neuroses, their self-limiting beliefs, their defense mechanisms over love. Love is right in front of them. But no, I might get hurt. I might get found out. Whatever might happen that has happened before. And they'll kick in their defense mechanisms, their self-limiting beliefs, their neuroses. Now, again, we all have them, but deep, intimate relationships are such beautiful opportunities to work through those. But that's what I come back to as to what I attribute to why so many relationships don't make it very far. Number one, they're challenging. They all are. But number two, as soon as you, like I said, dig in your heels and say, no, my defense mechanisms are more important than your love. And I've just experienced that over and over again. I want to love you. I want you to be happy. I want you to have a good life. I want us to have a good life. No, don't want that. Yeah, I act like I do. I say I do. But in truth, no, I'm going to protect myself. I'm going to manage my anxieties. I'm going to keep you at a distance. I'm not going to manage my moods. I'm going to withdraw. I mean, all those things. And again, unfortunately, I think that's what the majority of people do.
Yeah.
They will choose their neuroses, their defense mechanisms over love.
Yeah, and I mean, would you agree that like going again is super important? Because I mean, third time's a charm for you. And what if you just after your first marriage, you're like, you know what, this is too painful. I'm never gonna get hurt again. And I feel like I
Well,
see a lot of people do that.
a lot of people do it. They refer to first marriages as starter marriages. You're meant to make a few mistakes, right? Yeah, and then okay, move on. I've also heard the first child referred to as starter children too. Yeah, make all your mistakes on the first one, then toss them away and start over again. We have so many cultural stories and memes and expectations around marriage. And I had to deal with some sense of shame of being divorced, and I used to joke when after my second divorce, and when I started getting good at dating and teaching men to date and, doing classes and programs, I used to joke, I'm a marriage therapist who's been divorced twice, a dating guru that doesn't have a girlfriend, and people still line up to pay me money. So it is not so much that have we demonstrated, perfection at doing these things. I think most people are more attracted to, okay, you've struggled and learned. Because I tell people, no more Mr. Nice Guy. That's not a chronicle of my successes. It's a record of my fuck ups. It's the stuff I tried over and over again that didn't work. And then slowly I'd figure out other stuff. So when I met Lupita, met her probably about 10 years ago. I was walking down a street in Puerto Vallarta where I was living here part of the year, and I heard a voice that said, "Hola, señor, want a massage?" And I said, "No, hoy, tal vez mañana, más tarde." In Mexico, mañana doesn't mean tomorrow. Literally, it does, but it just means not now, some other time,
Another
right?
time, yeah.
And a buddy of mine was saying, "Robert, you need to pay more attention to your emotional dynamics, not just your head. I was on my way to a Starbucks, had my backpack, had my computer. I was going to go do some work. And I thought, I liked your voice. I mean, they do that here in, it's a tourist town. So you walk around, you hear all of them. Come on in. They're blasting music, want a massage, hola honeymooners, hey amigo, it's, to get you to come do their stuff. So I went back. I liked your voice. Turn around, walk back, said, how much? Got a massage. And then she about 6 months later, she basically propositioned me. And I said, why don't we go on a date? And we started dating. And then, like I said, we've been married 7.5 years now. But if you go back and listen to podcasts I recorded that I've got on my website during that period of when I was, single guy, right? I say there, I'll never get married again. I'll never live with another woman. I'll never raise another man's kids. You can find you can locate that if you try hard enough. You can hear me saying those things. I've also said I would also never dress a dog up in clothes either. But now my pit bull does have a hoodie and a sweater that she wears when it's cold out. And I'm married and I'm living with a woman and I'm raising another man's kids. Now, what happened is, those were some kind of boundaries I set for myself way back because of my tendency to get caught up in being this fixer. Oh, I can fix that. I can fix that. I can fix that. And I actually learned to really like living alone. And really valued that. And when I met Lupita, we dated, 2+ years, and then ended up buying a house here in Vallarta. That's where I am right now. And it's a big house, plenty of bedrooms, 5 bathrooms, swimming pool. And she lived, a really poor part of town, and a little place that didn't even have a bathroom door. And they had no windows. She opened kind of the big metal shade over her window at night. Men would come knock on her. She's a single woman. Of course, she wants to have sex. I mean, she's lived in this terrible place with 2 young kids. And so, I said, come live with me. She told me years later, I didn't know you were going to move me in with you. I said, really? You thought I was going to get this big house and leave you in a ghetto? And but then I had to struggle with the thing about getting married. And over time, I just had to sit with it. And I thought to myself, if I had not had bad experiences in my first 2 marriages, would I be projecting that I'm never getting married again onto Lupita? And I thought, no, not really. That's not her fault that I chose partners that were not good, not good relationship partners. They were good personal growth partners. They both grew me. If I didn't have that trauma, that baggage, would I project that on her? And I thought, no, I wouldn't. Actually, it's not fair. And then I asked myself, what's the most loving thing to do?
What a
And I
question.
said, without a doubt, it'd be to ask her to marry me. She'd never been married. She always said that, if I ever get married, I want to be with one man for my entire life. I also knew that, like financially, if we were living together and I died, she wouldn't have access to my Social Security or other things like that. And I just thought, she's got so much abandonment in her life, so much insecurity. Every man she's ever known's been a serial cheater. Every man she ever knows walked away from, their relationships. And not that I thought I want to fix that, but I thought if I can give her more sense of security and that she's loved and I'm in it, that's the most loving thing to do. So between those two questions, if I wasn't projecting my past, what would I do? And what would be the most loving thing? And it was a no-brainer, just ask her to marry me. And I'm so glad I did.
How
I
long were
mean,
you guys dating at that point when you did ask her?
I think we'd probably already moved in. So probably coming up on 3 years,
3 years, yeah.
coming up on 3 years. And about 5 years into our marriage, I found out a lot of stuff about her I didn't know.
Yep.
And after an ayahuasca ceremony, she said, I got to tell you some things. And
Uh-oh.
our relationship got even better after that,
Oh,
because
good.
then she could quit living with any kind of fear of what if I found those things out about her. So that just took it to another level.
Amazing. Well, there's so much value in this episode already, and I know we could go deeper and further, but I want to thank you for everything you've shared. And before we wrap up, how can people, what are you working on? How are you helping people right now, and where can they find and get access to it?
Well, The big project, that big business that I told you is a worldwide men's membership program that launched in July of 2023. And 2 years constructing it before we launched it. And we're it's going beautifully. New guys coming in every month. It's called Integration Nation. And it's just, you know, my goal is that every man on this planet that wants to be in a men's program should have access. And I'm trying to provide that. Our mantra is good men doing better. So we really work on leveling up to the best version of ourselves, living our best lives, letting go of our shame. It's hard to level up if you're packing around shame. Building community for men, masculine initiation. So if they want to go check out integrationnation.net, that's go look at that for the guys. And then my website, my other professional website's drglover.com. Drglover. It has my online courses, including my All the Way In relationship course, Nice Guys Don't Finish Last, a Rotten Middle Management course. It's got podcasts, links to my books, consultation, workshops. So that's all at drglover.com, the men's community, integrationnation.net.
Amazing. This should go out saying, go without saying, and I talked about this on our first podcast, but I'll say it again now. I read your book, obviously, many times. It got to a point where, you know, I don't want to offend religious people, but your book was kind of like a little bit of a Bible for me, where every morning,
I've heard that.
every
We won't
morning,
offend anybody, but I've heard that.
I would wake up every morning and I would do a page, you know, kind of like I would sit down, I'd do a page, I'd do the exercise if there was an exercise on that one.
Good for
And I,
you.
oh my God, your book, I mean, totally changed my life. And then it was cool because I got to spread it to other people. My physical therapist at the time was the biggest nice guy in Manhattan. And he was doing physical therapy for free, and he couldn't tell people they owed him money and all this stuff. And it was cool because it got to the point where someone from his temple was like, "Hey, man, I'm going to come over after service. I need you to stretch me out." And he was like, "Well, no, you can book an appointment, come in my office." And the guy's like, "No, it'll just be like 15 minutes. Like, we're friends, right?" And he's like, "No, you can pay me cash, or you could just do it in my point." And the guy was like, "No," and he stormed out of the t and then he texted him later. He's like, "Hey man, how do I book an appointment?"
I love it. I love it. Yeah, this stuff works, you know. And again, it's not about becoming an asshole or a jerk.
No.
It's about becoming conscious and authentic and being boundaried and asking for what you want and being honest, honest, all that good stuff.
Having
And
a
open-hearted. So
yeah.
all that good stuff.
Yeah.
I love the story. That's a great
Yeah.
story.
No, and check this out. So there was a no, I'm sure you know this, but there's no more Mr. Nice Guy groups all over, which it sounds like you're
Sure.
now starting to consolidate with your program. But there was a New York City meetup, and I brought this guy. He was like a
Yeah.
little bit timid to go by himself. So I said, "Hey, I'll bring you." And it was a bunch of guys, and they were talking through the exercises. And so you really created this movement, which is super powerful.
I like knowing it's made a difference. I really do. And it's my legacy. You know, we're all going to die. I'm not going to be around forever. I've had a couple near-death experiences. Just okay. Live for today because that's all we got. You know, most men my age are retiring. They're out playing golf, doing whatever. And I thought, nah, I'm in it for another 20 years. I'm in too important of a position to just, you know, say, nah, I'm ready to go retire. So I love what I do, and I'm changing the world. So I like knowing that.
That's awesome, man. Well, hey, if you and Lupita make it up to San Diego, or next time I'm down in Mexico, we should
All right.
catch up in person.
All right, let's do it. I love San Diego. It's one of my favorite places. Great town. Great town.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Dr. Glover, thanks again so much for coming on the show.
Brendan, thank you very much. I had a good time.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of The Brendan Burns Show. If it's your first time here, please make sure to subscribe on the Apple Podcasts app or in Spotify. Also, please leave us a rating or written review. This helps others learn about the show and spread the word to new and more people. Thanks again for listening, and have a great day.